Hello, I'm Brandon Martini, a commercial pilot and flight instructor.
And I'm Carson Vasquez, I'm a private pilot.
And you're listening to the Aviation Mentors podcast, sponsored by Stratus Financial.
So buckle up, because the Aviation Mentors are taking off.
Welcome back to another amazing and awesome episode of the Aviation Mentors podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today. Today's episode, we're actually going to be going over some common misconceptions we hear from non-pilots, student pilots, and even seasoned pilots, or as Carson affectionately likes to say, too confident of pilots. So I'm a pretty confident pilot. What do you think about me? You think I'm too confident, Carson?
I think you're plenty confident, but I definitely think you're a little bit cocky. Just a little bit, but just enough.
Well, you know what? I have one thing to say to that, Carson.
What's that? All I do is win, win,
win, no matter what. It's true. It's what I do.
Correct. Yeah, we are winners. We both are, and that doesn't mean I have to be cocky, though. But you do you, Brandon. Whatever makes you happy, right?
I'm going to keep being me. And I hope everyone's seen our video from the Philippines. We have it posted. I don't know if we have it on our Aviation Mentors post yet, but we'll share that on our Aviation Mentors pages. And check out the video. You get to see all of us having a great time. There's one part of it where I'm in the video with a few of our other team members, and we've got our canoe that we handmade, and we're raising it up into the sky, and this is what we were singing. So that was my theme the entire weekend there, obviously.
Yeah, that was actually audio from that video, so that's even better. And why don't we do one better than just posting it? We'll put it in the description right below, so you guys can go check it out.
Nice.
Yeah, it's a good one. Anyway, let's go over some of the most common misconceptions, or at least just kind of respectfully, or maybe disrespectfully, just dumb things I've heard. And we'll start off strong. Thank you. We just found out that Brandon's the only one that has the soundboard. I don't have a soundboard. And Brandon found out, and he's really happy I don't have one. So whenever you hear a sound, just know it's not me. Nice. I wouldn't do you guys like that. So, all right. So nice. The first one, knock that off. So the first one is...
Nice.
What's the bad part about this right now is for some reason I can't hear it. So I keep on pressing play again, not knowing that the soundboard's just playing for everybody else. Let me try it again.
Nice.
There we go.
Now you hear it? All right. We tried to do this episode already. We got like a minute in and Brandon's had technical difficulties for the past like 25 minutes. So now we're trying to do this again. So let's keep going. The first one is if I can fly a simulator, I can fly a plane. Brandon, what do you think about that?
I think absolutely you should go jump in the airplane. You can fly it right away. I mean, it's going to be hands down. It's going to be easy, but you know how to start it. You know how to pre-flight it.
It's exactly the same as a simulator.
It's exactly the same.
Exactly the same. The same feeling. Yeah. You can solo it right away.
Yeah. Don't do that. That was very much sarcasm. And if you're one of the crazy people that actually think that, good for you. And the answer is, can you fly better than a person who's never touched the airplane controls before? Yep. I guarantee you'll be able to fly better than somebody else, especially in the sky. But I will tell you that the skills learned on a simulator versus learned in a real aircraft are very different based on feel. A real aircraft is going to feel different than a simulator. Granted, I would say the people who've got like the 1,000 hours of simulator time, those people catch on to all the skills really, really quickly because they already understand how an airplane flies. They already understand what kind of a sight picture looks like. I would say it gives you an upper hand. But I would not say that you can go fly the airplane. I would not say that you can go land a large aircraft on an aircraft carrier. I would not say that you can go land a Boeing 737 at LAX because you've flown a bunch of simulator time. Will it make certain skills a little easier for you down the line? Yes. But it's also going to make certain skills a little harder because now you've trained yourself on a bunch of bad habits because no one taught you that they were wrong. And it's going to actually be harder for you to get through certain skill sets. And usually that has to do with landing or taking off, to be honest.
Yeah, but I've seen a couple demo flights at least where just some kid that put 1,000+ hours on a simulator and the controls, you know, they're all the same and they've done pretty well. So it's pretty cool to see it happen and to see the skills translate. So you understand when you're in an actual simulator, not just playing Microsoft Flight Sim, you know, things are a little bit different, right?
Are you serious?
On to the next question, because I think we kind of beat that one, especially with all my my soundboard stuff. The next question is, I only need to check the weather if I'm going far. I love that. How do you feel about that, Carson? Do you think you should only check the weather if you're going far? And by the way, I would love to know what the people who say this, what they consider far. Like, do they consider the pattern altitude far? Obviously not, because pattern altitude is not far enough for them to check the weather, sounds like.
No, I've heard students say, yeah, I don't need to check the TAF. I only need to check the METAR because I'm not going that far. I think TAFs are only good for, like, what, 6 nautical miles or so from the origination airport? Something close. It's like 6 to 10, maybe 15. I don't know. It's not far. So I would always check the TAF. I mean, that's super important. Checking the METAR is not going to just be enough because weather can change. What if a thunderstorm's coming, right? You're not going to know just from the METAR. That kind of stuff shows up in the TAF. And the winds changed, winds aloft. Everything's different from just the first weather you see just by looking out the window, right?
Carson, would you like me to correct you?
Yeah, go for it.
Perfect. So it's approximately 5 statute miles from the center of where the TAF was calculated. So just so you know.
See, I didn't think I was far off, but you're giving me a weird look. And as a CFI, whenever you give me a weird look, it's like the same look your CFI gives you before they pull out the power and say, your engine failed, go find somewhere to land. So you're giving me that look. So I just wanted to be sure.
You could probably use it up to 10 or even 20 miles, like for kind of an estimation, but they're only saying it's 5. And to be honest, kind of depending on who you ask, it could be 6 miles. So between 5 and 10.
Yeah, so that's close enough. But just looking out the window and looking up in the sky, you're going to see a clear sky. It's not going to tell you anything. You're just going to know there's no clouds, right? You're not going to tell anything about the wind, the turbulence, anything that's going on. So that kind of stuff, even if you're just going in the pattern, check the weather.
Always check the weather. I don't care if you're going in the pattern, if you're going on a short cross country that's only 3 miles away. That doesn't count as an actual cross-country loggable, by the way. It just counts as an airport-to-airport operation. But I would check the weather as much as you can for your entire trip. I mean, you're supposed to do that every time you go fly. You're supposed to check all the NOTAMs, check everything you're supposed to check.
Yeah. All right. I think we beat that one too. So the next one is, I can skip the pre-flight inspection if I flew yesterday and everything was fine. So for the purposes of this, let's just say either two things. It was your own plane, you put it back in the hangar after you flew it. Or two, you're a student, because I've done this before, not the skip the pre-flight. But I've been the last one to fly it that evening and the first one to fly it in the morning, and I still did pre-flight. So Brandon, what do you think?
I'll tell you what I do. If I ever walk away from the aircraft after I do a pre-flight, I redo the pre-flight. I might not do it as in-depth, but I'm going to go walk around and make sure that that nothing hit the airplane. A bird didn't just fly into it for some reason. I mean, birds do stupid things. I mean, I look out my window all the time, and the other day I had one sitting on my patio and it was like squawking at me while I was on a Zoom call. It was ridiculous. So birds do ridiculous things. Don't put it past them for them to fly into your wing for some reason, like a little dumb bird. So that's possible. What's more possible than a bird flying into your airplane or something, which sounds fun but not realistic, is somebody's either taxiing near your airplane and taps it, or somebody taxis under your wing like they shouldn't do and they end up hitting something, or somebody is just pulling another airplane around and it does something to it and it just nicks part of the airplane. So always, whenever I walk away from the airplane, I go back and do at least a walk around on the plane. If I walk away for a long time, I don't know, maybe more than 20 minutes, I'll do a full pre-flight all over again. I mean, I can do a pre-flight pretty fast, but if you're a student, that might take you 30 minutes. So keep that in mind, okay? Also, for the people that said, well, I did the pre-flight yesterday, I know everything was happening, and it was in a hangar, and I was the last one to use it, and all this other stuff. Well, guess what? Birds sometimes fly in and make a little nest. I guarantee a bird can make a nest overnight. I've seen them do it. So maybe not all birds can do that, but there's a lot of them that can make a nest overnight, and that nest can be inside of your cowling. So yes, you need to still do the pre-flight. Condensation can sometimes form overnight and you might get that moisture inside your fuel tank. So make sure you do the pre-flight inspection before you go fly. Go check that oil again. Make sure you didn't have some oil leak that you didn't know about. And now you lost like 3 quarts of your oil and it was dark in your hangar in the morning when you showed back up and you didn't really see it, or you've got floors that are painted a certain color and you didn't notice. There's all sorts of things. So go do the pre-flight again. I mean, I would never skip the pre-flight. That is your number one way to mitigate your risk prior to taking that aircraft off the ground.
I think you did a good job. I think you wrapped it up pretty good. That was all the CFI voice that I could take for that one. So
good. I couldn't go much more.
I'm glad you cut that one.
So, all right. The next question we're going to go to is, I can rely on GPS for all my navigation.
Brandon, how many times have you heard the Children of the Magenta Line thing come from, at least from an older pilot? How many times have you heard that?
I don't know if I've actually ever heard it come from an older pilot, but I've heard people talk about it online.
Oh, older pilots, because when I worked the front desk of the flight school, I heard it all the time. All the old pilots I'd come in by charts specifically were the ones saying that.
Carson, how old's an old pilot to you?
Like 35.
Yeah, so my age, I thought so. Yeah.
No, it was 65 plus, older.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I could see that. All the older pilots that are against the iPads and only want the paper charts and all that stuff. So I get that.
Yeah, but anyway, back to the question itself. I always carry the paper charts with me, the current paper charts for wherever I'm at or wherever I'm going, because the last thing you want is for your iPad to die on you, for if you're using 4Flight, or some sort of battery issue and your whole electrical system's out. That's the last thing you want when you're flying somewhere you don't know, especially. Or if you're trying to get a frequency. I mean, the era that we flew, it was completely glass panel. And there was an issue sometimes where if we didn't update the GPS, the charts weren't updated as well. And you couldn't use them because they're out of date. And you have to use paper charts because that's technically the only thing that's legal. So there's just right way to do things and a wrong way to do things. And if you're only relying on GPS with no sort of backup, you just can't trust it.
I semi-disagree, Carson. I have multiple backups. Matter of fact, FAA just came up with a letter of interpretation or something today. I haven't read it yet, so I'm going to go read it this afternoon, though, because it's on my to-do list. And they're basically saying that you can have a 100% fully electronic cockpit now. You do not have to have paper charts, and it has been specified by the FAA. AOPA put an article out about it today, but like I said, I haven't read it yet, so I will read it later on today. I will say...
Back in
my day, I did not have 4Flight, and I actually did my cross country without a GPS, with VORs, and timed everything, and I did it all legit, and I didn't do it. This is my 10-year anniversary of becoming a pilot this year, so we should celebrate that, Carson, in June, by the way. June is my 10-year anniversary.
Let's do it.
Yeah, but I would say that as long as you have multiple backups for your EFB, or electronic flight bag, like an extra iPad or an extra phone or something, then I would say it's okay. You could follow that magenta line. You can do those things. I don't have a problem with it particularly. Now, when you're learning, I don't think you should learn to just fly direct to everywhere. And that's for one reason. I think that when you're learning like time to each waypoint and things like that with regular navigation techniques, I think that teaches you other skills when it pertains to flying, especially when you graduate to IFR flying. So I'm big on teaching the old school skills with some electronic kind of amenities to it. So I don't mind if you rely all on GPS, but what I will say, if you live in a place like Southern California and you're going to Vegas, they have GPS outages quite often, several times per year, sometimes without notification or advanced notification. It just kind of happens right away. And that's because of military testing. They're not going to tell enemies that this is the time that they're going to be testing GPS outages. And sometimes that affects your route of flight, and it can affect your route of flight from here to Vegas or here to different places on the Southwest. So keep that in mind when you're trying to rely on GPS. So that's why a lot of people are like, well, we can't ever get rid of VORs because there's GPS outages due to military operations semi-often. I don't know how that's going to impact us in the future. I don't know what the next iteration of GPS will be, but I know that tends to be an issue at altitude. Obviously, we all use GPS on the ground. It's not really an issue here, but at altitude, it can be. All right, the next question we're going to go to is, having better instruments like a glass panel means I will have less problems. I disagree wholly. Having a glass panel means you're going to have just as many problems, if not more. Wait till that glass panel blacks out on you and you have to go to your backup on the right side, or you don't have a backup and you've got to go to just your artificial horizon as your backup, and then you need to go land. I mean, these are some issues you can have. I've had a glass panel go totally black on me. I've also had it go unreliable on me. The more electronics on a small airplane, the more things you can fail. When you have a standard six pack, you definitely have like different instruments can fail, but they're not going to normally fail all at the same time. They're going to fail at different times. Yeah, glass cockpit's going to fail all at once. Now, granted, there's ways for certain items to fail all by themselves, but overall, you're going to lose that entire panel. That's pretty terrible.
So yeah, you're going to have different problems, not less problems. And you just have to know how to handle those ones. But on to the next one about having different problems as well. Having two engines means you are twice as safe. Brandon, Mr. MEI, go for it.
I actually semi-agree with this. I think if you have two engines and you know how to manage engine out procedures, I think you're more safe. I think that flying at night, IFR, anywhere in the U.S., if you lose an engine in your single engine, you're not going to be able to see where you're going down. It's going to be pretty difficult unless you're just flying near an airport and you get lucky. I think it's going to be pretty difficult to get a safe spot to land. Now, if you're flying a multi-engine, and there's a reason besides regulations that airliners have two engines, it's because it's safer. It's more redundant. All airliners have multiple redundant systems, and one of those systems is just a second engine, or sometimes they've got three extra engines, depending on what you're flying, right? So yes, I don't know if it means you're twice as safe. It could also mean you're twice as dangerous. I know a few years ago, there's a pilot that was flying a 310 and did not do the proper engine out procedures and ended up crashing right before Santa Ana Airport, John Wayne, SNA, in Southern California. And it's because I haven't read the report in a long time, but he didn't properly secure his engine and feather it. And he ended up losing altitude and he crashed before he hit the runway. Now, him and his passenger ended up coming right out of the airplane without a problem, but that airplane was totaled. It was on fire. They got burned. It wasn't good because they weren't practicing single engine maneuvers anymore. I don't know. I'm just making a guess, but he probably hadn't done single engine operations in years and years and years. He was an older pilot. He's been flying a long time. I bet you whoever did his BFR was one of his friends and just signed him off and they went flying together. It was like, oh, you're still good. And in reality, no, he was not still good. He was still missing a lot of hard skills that no one taught him over years and years and years. So it can mean you're less safe, but there's a possibility it could mean more safe. It really all depends on your skill level and how much you train and how proficient you stay. We talk about being current and proficient or Carson super current. Proficiency is really the key. You need to be proficient with those two engines. If you're not proficient with those two engines, it's going to be less safe. So keep that in mind. And I'm going to go into the last question we have of the day. And this is a funny one. Fuel management is just about having enough fuel to get there. How you feel about that, Carson?
I agree. Yeah, you just have to be able to get to where you're going. And as long as you can get to where you're going, you have enough. You need to make that extra stop to have extra fuel. Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, exactly. So don't listen to what Carson just said. That was total BS and satire, FYI. No, fuel management is really about having enough fuel to get to where you want to go and ample fuel left over, right? So like VFR minimums is 30 minutes additional. I'll tell you this. I flew one time from Phoenix to Albuquerque in a Cessna 172, and I landed with 35 minutes of reserve. I was forecast to land with like an hour and 15 minutes, but it was nighttime. There were thunderstorms surrounding. I had to go zigzag my way through. I was dealing with density altitude and with a screaming Austin in the back because he was younger and a baby. All of these things were difficult for me to deal with, right? And I ended up getting there with 35 minutes or maybe even 40 minutes of fuel reserve. One of my tanks was really, really empty and the other one was really, really empty. And when I checked, I was really nervous because my fuel gauges were showing close to empty before I landed. And I still had 30 to 40 minutes of reserve when I checked the fuel tanks with the stick. But I'll tell you this, it was butt pucker time. I did not like feeling that way. It was horrible. So now I have my own limit. Every time I go fly, I fly 3-hour legs. I don't fly more than that, because I'd rather have 5 hours of fuel and I just fly a 3-hour leg. I'll go land. I'll go to the bathroom. That's all my bladder's really got for it anyways. And I'll get what's the most important thing. More water, more snacks from the FBO. And of course, the most important thing, I'm going to go get more fuel. Always have more fuel, unless it puts you overweight. Obviously, that's a little bit different. But go have more fuel. I don't like flying with a little bit of fuel. That's no good. You got to fly with ample amounts of fuel. It's really, really important. You don't want to be that statistical pilot that crashes because you ran out of fuel. And everyone can tell you ran out of fuel because there's no fireball. You just land and it just crashes. So don't do that. Don't be an idiot. Go have a lot of fuel or as much as you need plus ample to get you to the next stop. Obviously, you need VFR and IFR minimums, but have more than that. Go above those FAA mandated margins and really have enough fuel to make you feel safe when you land, because you don't want to have that feeling that I had when I landed in Albuquerque area.
I think getting down to minimums like that is just, it's a terrifying thought. And landing at 40 minutes alone is scary enough. Just checking your fuel. You have to trust that you checked your fuel right and you read the stick right, you have the right memory, or at least wrote down the right numbers. You have to trust that your gauges are being reading correct. And that's a little bit too much to count on all at once to be able to push your plane a little farther to just get there. It's not worth the risk and just land and get some more fuel. So, Brandon, I totally agree. But I hope you guys had a fun time with this. We like going over stuff like the Reddit questions and listener questions and going over just things that we think of, misconceptions and stuff that we hear. So I hope you guys enjoyed it too. And I know Brandon did. He's been smiling and playing with the sound effects. So he's having a good time.
You know why, Carson?
Why, Brandon?
On that note, if you would like to reach out to either one of us, you can reach us at our emails, Brandon@AviationMentors.com, Carson@AviationMentors.com, or for our producer, Marcus, producer@AviationMentors.com. Also, don't forget to hit like, subscribe, follow, all of the things that help us grow on whatever streaming platform you're listening to us on. It's an absolute huge part of helping us grow the podcast and helping us grow the aviation community at large. So thank you so much for joining us today. It means the most to us, and we really appreciate you helping grow general aviation and flight training in general.
Thanks, everyone. As a wrap up for the day, remember, here to guide you in your aviation journey. So fly safe and enjoy the ride.
See ya.